For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, we ready? Let's go. I'm going to pray, and then we're going to dive in here. Jesus, give us a new heart and a new vision for what you're doing in our day and our culture. Father, encourage us by seeing what's going on in the church globally. At the same time, you give us a heavy dose of reality of the things that are occurring right here in our own midst. And give us creativity, Father, to think through what kind of wineskins do we need to create to hold the powerful wine of your gospel in our day. We ask that you do that in Jesus' name. Amen. My name's Craig, and I'm a waiter, a church planter, a pastor, a part-time model. Right now, a lot of what I do is I lead an alternative seminary. A lot of what I'm going to talk about here comes out of that context because I have seen a significant shift in young leaders that I'm developing and a change in the kinds of churches we're going to have to plant if we're going to be effective in the next generation here. All right, now I'm going to brain dump on you here, and I really apologize. I know you're getting that all the time here now, but I'm going to give you what I would call a slow-release capsule. You're going to get a lot of information. You can take notes if you want to, but also I'm going to encourage you, if you just want all the information, I'll give you an email address. You tell me you want it, and I'll send it all to you. Also, I need to say before I jump in here, a lot of the stuff I'm going to share with you, particularly statistical information, you should have a high level of cynicism about. You know, like their pastors are always quoting statistics, and you're like, mm-hmm, right. I have tried as best as I am able. I spent time again. I've done this for a while. I have tried to triple check all statistics. I am not putting anything up here that I don't at least have two sources for. I also have tried to be careful about the kind of sources I go to, because there are sources that do accurate demographic work and polling, and then there are sources that kind of from the hip. They may be right, but they're not necessarily reliable. So I'm going to try and give you an accurate picture here. Please question what I'm saying. If it's wrong, please correct me. Let's get this right. But what I have found is that the church in America has a very distorted picture of what's going on. They're not really clear. They know something's going on, but they're not very clear at all what it is, and we'll talk about why. Okay, years ago I was at a leadership deal with Bill Hybels, pastor in Chicago, and he was talking to a bunch of leaders, and they were asking him, so how do you know whether someone in your midst has the gift of leadership or not? And he went through a bunch of, like, definitions, but then he let slip what I think was his real definition. He said, for me, I know someone's got leadership gifts when they smell entropy before anybody else. So, what do you mean? They go, well, I know somebody's a leader when everybody else thinks things are going great, but they see around the corner, they know what's about to happen, and they can kind of smell that. They can tell something's about to change. Entropy is the idea from physics that things die. They have an end. And so he says, leaders have that ability to smell entropy. I think about this material and my own path, and I go, whatever degree of leadership God's entrusted to me, I began getting a whiff of entropy for the American church back in the mid-80s. I went after my seminary, I did postgraduate work in Edinburgh, Scotland, so I lived in Scotland. And it was quite an experience. It was really like seeing a place where a spiritual nuclear bomb had gone off. You're like, what the heck happened here? I was at the University of Edinburgh, I knew that one generation prior to that, it was the center, at least of Reformed theology in the Western world. Today, a comparative religion department at best. I'm like, what happened here? I was really shocked by it. In my arrogance as a typical American, I was secretly thinking to myself, thank God this is not true for us back home. Little did I know that I was seeing previews of coming attractions. Because what I saw was, there's still a church there. Like, for instance, we went down one weekend, because I'm a church history buff, to see the church that George Whitefield founded. Whitefield, one of the greatest preachers in history. And that morning, my wife and my three sons and I were larger than the congregation there. And I thought, well, maybe it's an off day. They said, no, this is a big day for us. It's Whitfield's birthday. four people in the congregation, five of us. And again, I was like, what happened? Incredible cathedral. I mean, we talk about buildings, it's like, wow, they got the building thing going on big time. And nothing going on. I thought something happened here, and it slipped away from them without them really even noticing it. In fact, in Edinburgh, the church that I worked in, you know, unlike in America where it's like, hey, invite your neighbors to church. In Scotland, the reaction would be from a neighbor, they'd be like, well, I think that's neat that you guys do whatever you do over there. I know other people knit. I don't knit. That's how they viewed church. Like a specialized little hobby that a few people do, but a shrinking small number of people. So I came back kind of with that arrogance built in and going, oh, thank goodness that's not true in our context. And then over the last 20 plus years, I started going, uh-oh, we're seeing very similar patterns. And I'll go through those. I mentioned I teach an alternative seminary. I train students to go plant churches for next generation. And one of the things, another place I smelled this entropy is, in the early 90s, I started taking groups of students up to kind of evaluate things that were going on at Willow Creek Church. You all know Willow Creek in Chicago. Amazing stuff. And they would go up, and their reactions would be, wow, wow, can we do that? Can we have a cafeteria? Can we give away cars? I mean, they just would come back like unbelievable. About 5 or 6 years later, the same groups of students I'd take up, most of those are in their early 20s, they had a completely different reaction. Their reaction was, wow, oh my gosh, I would never bring my friend to this. It's like, whoa, what just happened there? What just happened? Well, you can call it whatever you want. I know a lot of church leaders call it the shift to postmodernism, and I totally get that. Whatever it is, something's changed in our context, something drastic. In fact, if you want to read about that, I think a pretty good book on it is Josh McDowell, used to be an expert in youth ministry in America, wrote a book called The Last Christian Generation, in which he points out the wild demographic differences between those under 30 and those over 30 in America. It's like something really, really changed. We can give it all kinds of different labels. But a leader understands we can't do things the same way. I started seeing this. I had planted a church in 1986. We were primarily a seeker model church. I got enormous help and encouragement from the guys at Willow Creek. They were such a help to me. And we saw externally a lot of fruit. We even saw a lot of lost people who responded to the claims of the gospel, because we'd say, invite your neighbor, barbecue with them, and then invite them. And they would come. But we would do a thing, we had a deal we called The Bridge, where three times a year we'd invite people who'd responded to the gospel at a weekend service to come on a weekend retreat and kind of answer the question, what next? I honestly wasn't sure that many of them would do that, but they did. We'd run about 30 to 50 new Christians who'd show up, and guess what my biggest problem was? I could not get Christians to invest in. I was shocked at the time. I was like, well, that's the whole reason we're doing this. And guess what their answer would be? We're way too busy with church activities. We're like, not zero. I had some core people who'd do it, and they'd be burnt out. They'd invest in discipleship in person, and then they'd go, I can't take on any more people and be a healthy person. This started me asking a lot of questions. I go, in a large church where we're getting a response, we can't cash the check. And so I began articulating, actually, I think I read some stuff that helped me with this, but I began thinking through that the goal of ministry is not to draw a crowd. And we had sold out in the Western church for this idea of, what do we need to do to draw a big crowd? I go, well, the goal is making disciples. Now, I know, honestly, I think in my heart sincerely, and I know in a lot of other churches, they sincerely thought, if we could draw a big crowd, then we'll be able to make disciples. But after that experience in that church, I was there for 18 years, I handed it off to one of my students, I was thinking, you know, I could probably do the same level of discipleship with 10 good leaders. for a whole lot less money, a whole lot less energy. We could produce about the same number of disciples. I go, something's wrong here. We're going to have to look in the mirror. Last one I want to tell about this is a shameful one. But I had seen the movie Waterboy with Adam Sandler, and I'm not encouraging you to necessarily go see it, but in Waterboy, this guy that has some mental challenges but is a ridiculous football player, even though he's currently just the water boy, he's in class at the university, and this guy here, who looked like Colonel Sanders, is lecturing and kind of humiliating the students, and he says something about Adam Sandler's mother, and it just wigs him out. So he gets up, runs down the aisle, and tackles this guy, breaking his arms and legs. That's kind of one of the ongoing jokes in the movie. Well, I tell you that because I had a dream, and I'm not going to blame an Adam Sandler movie on God, but I think that God was in it. In this dream, I'm thinking about these things. I'm thinking, okay, so what do we need to do about this? And I can't really remember the details of the dream. You know how it is. You just kind of have swatches of it. But in the dream, I'm sometime well into the future, like the Ghost of Christmas Past is taking me to a seminary classroom in the future, and there's this guy in my dream, I do remember that, is lecturing on church history. And his lecture is talking about how the church in America died out in 2020. It became an unreached people group in the world. And again, I'm like, I don't know what I am, and hovering over this deal, but in me, in the dream, at least best I can remember, I shout out, not on my watch, jump up, run across the room, and tackle the dude, break his arms and legs. Then I woke up, and my wife's looking at me like, are you okay? So she's like, did you have a weird dream? And I was like, I don't really even know how to tell this one to you. But the point is that I had this deep sense, this part was from God, I had this sense, I don't want to be a leader in the generation that watches the wine leak out of the wineskin in America. I don't want to be around for that. At least I want to go down swinging. I don't want to be the guy that went like, yeah, we just kept doing things as we'd been doing them to build our own little kingdoms, but the kingdom of God shrunk consistently there. That's what I want to talk about. What's going on? Why is the wine leaking in America today? And what do we do about it? How are we supposed to respond to that? Okay, Jesus put it this way in Matthew chapter 9. He starts off telling a little parable about patch. And then he goes on and talks about you don't put new wine into old wineskins. Now, new wine breathes, so I'm told. As a result, it expands. It literally expands. And so as wineskins, what they would use to carry wine in Jesus' day, as the expansion of new wine would occur, it would literally burst the wineskin and it would get a leak in it. Now, Jesus is saying this in Matthew 9 in a context where the Pharisees are basically asking him, why don't your guys do ministry the way we do it? Why don't they wash the hands the way we do? Why don't they exercise the Sabbath the same way we do? What's wrong with your leaders, Jesus? Why won't your disciples do it the right way? He tells them this as a way to respond. In essence, I believe Jesus is saying, look, the new wine of the gospel, it's living and active. And it never changes. But wineskins burst. They're meant to be temporary. They burst all the time. Anybody who carries wine around understands you've got to replace your wineskin every once in a while or it'll burst a leak and you'll lose your valuable wine. That's really what we're talking about here. How do we recognize, first of all, and you may conclude I'm not correct in this, but I'm going to suggest that we're leaking badly. The wineskin in the American church is leaking badly. The wine of the gospel, by the way, I think that we went through a period, I'm not picking on all of their stuff, but the emergent movement, I think, was the first movement in America to smell that entropy. Something's wrong. We got to fix this. Now, this is my read. You don't have to own this. But my read is that many of them decided, let's have new wineskins, and while we're at it, let's change the wine recipe. And I think that was a big mistake. So I think we're still left, though, going, okay, so how do we maintain the integrity of the wine of the gospel while we figure out new wineskins to put it in our day? Let me give you one more example of this. I was talking about this stuff, about that parable, and a group of businessmen, and this guy came up to me afterwards and he said, "Hey, you're just talking about the buggy whip." I go, "I don't know what you're talking about." He goes, "I went to Harvard Business School. If you get an MBA at Harvard, you have to do the buggy whip case study." I said, "Again, I'm really unfamiliar." And so he began to instruct me in it. It was written by a guy named Theodore Levitt. He published it in the Harvard Business Review in 1960. It was called Marketing Myopia. And I understand, even though it could have changed recently, that Harvard still is the entry case study in their business school, is you've got to read through the corporate minutes of this organization. They were the dominant buggy whip manufacturers in the United States. And sales begin declining. And so as you read the case study, the minutes of their yearly corporate meetings, every year they're trying to come up with a different patch. First year, we have bad materials. We need to upgrade the materials of our stuff. Different distributors that get us the leather, etc., still continue to decline. So they come back and they basically say, "Okay, we need to restructure the organization." And so they get rid of middle management and try and figure out how to get leaner and meaner there. Still have a decline in sales. The third year, they run around with the idea, "We got a problem with marketing. We're marketing incorrectly." And so they work the marketing angle. Still decline. I think it's either the fourth or the fifth year, some guy stands up in the corporate minutes and says, "Guys, the problem is called Henry Ford. He created this thing called an automobile, and no matter how good a buggy whips we make, we're going to continue to see declining sales. The context has changed. And we've got to kind of look in the mirror and go, okay, doesn't mean we can't continue to be effective, but we cannot expect the same effectiveness we were getting before." And I would say this for me was a really helpful thing. I thought the American church, to some degree, even though we're in pretty severe decline, we continue to say we need to do the same stuff a little better. We need a few more Bill Hybels. We need to build cooler, more functional buildings. We need bigger parking lots. Even though the evidence is in and we know that stuff's not working, we know that, we're still going, "Yeah, but if we try a little harder at that, we think it'll work." Well, that's what I'm going to lay before you. When the context change, wineskins become obsolete. Let me talk a little bit about the context, because again, whatever you call it, this question of, has the context in America changed? By the way, I have not met hardly any leaders who push back on this, who've been around for a while. I haven't had anybody going like, "I think you're wrong. I think the context is exactly the same as it was in 1960. It's like, no, they're very aware of that. If you want to read a book that will scare you and cause you to have problems at night, I make my students read this book, The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe. One's a sociologist, one's a historian at Stanford. I think one of them died just recently here. You're familiar with their work, even though you don't know it, because these are the guys who created generational language. So if you've ever heard anybody referred to as a baby boomer, Strauss and Howe. Millennial, busters, Generation X, all those terminologies are things that they created because they have spent their lives academically studying generational cycles. They talk in this book about what they discovered from the Romans. The Romans had a concept they called a seculum. A seculum was a season or generation of about 80 to 120 years. Now, as I read this biblically, I had to go like, "Guys, I hate to tell you this, but the concept of generation, in fact, the word genea, is rooted in Scripture, which talks about in the generation of Abraham." A genea is a significant part of the whole concept of Scripture, that each generation makes choices. And in fact, the Old Testament follows through these cycles that they're going to talk about. Now, a little differently, but I think what they talk about you can see played out in the book of Judges, where those cycles of history repeat themselves over and over again generationally. The people cry out for a deliverer. God sends them a judge who delivers them mightily. They have a significant high era where they experience great affinity in their culture. And then it begins to unravel. They follow foreign gods. They fall into some kind of disrepair and cry out to God, send us to deliver again, and the cycle starts all over again. The Romans called that four turnings. They said every seculum has four basic turnings that follow the seasons of the year, summer, winter, spring, and fall. And they say they're very similar. And they say that cycle often starts out with a crisis period in history where something so affects everyone in the culture that they either have to respond heroically or that culture disappears. And they point out, that's why you know a lot about Roman culture. It made it through a lot of cycles. They kept answering the bell of crisis. But you don't know hardly anything about Mesopotamia, even though they were a far mightier empire. They only answered the bell twice, and then they disappear. So we don't know that much about them in history. We study Egypt, we study various cultures, because they kept this cycle going for long periods of time. Probably the longest one in the book, they would say, was the Ming Dynasty in China. They kept responding. But they would say it begins with a crisis, which, if they're victorious in that crisis, the culture experiences a high period. From that high period, they begin to kind of assume their liberties or their advances, which leads them into an awakening period where they begin to question stuff, which leads to an unraveling era, where the central ideas of that culture start unraveling and they can find no longer any sense of unity in anything. Okay, so they would point out, and I would be in full agreement here, that we are currently in America in an unraveling era. And I have not found many people on the left or the right disagree with us. Now, they got different reasons why, but they're pretty much all in agreement. Yep, we're unraveling as a culture. Have you ever seen the red-blue state maps? It's not a bad picture. By the way, I had somebody, I had a professor that laid that map on top of a Civil War map, and you went, uh-oh, we've seen this movie before. But they would say that last change from the unraveling era to the crisis is what they call a fourth turning. They say it is a crisis moment in a culture that affects everyone. I had my students start reading this in 2000. So can you imagine their response on 9/11? Here it is. Strauss and Howe came out immediately and go, no, definitely not a fourth turn. This is not a crisis moment. This is a tremor, but it only really directly affects a small number of people, percentage-wise. And they would say that historically, they are things that affect everybody immediately in almost every aspect. So they would say the last fourth turnings in America, the Revolutionary War, Civil War, Great Depression, and World War II, and they would say, do not try and predict this because you will never be right. But somewhere they suggest if the pattern stays true between 2020 and 2050, I think the way Strauss puts it is America will cross through a dark bridge that this generation has never experienced. I'm very aware when I take young leaders, they have no concept of this. They don't even remember grandparents who went through that crisis. I sometimes will show them the movie. It's an old black and white movie, Mr. Roberts. Anybody seen Mr. Roberts here? One best picture. It's Henry Fonda and Jack Lemmon as a young man. And it's about these guys on a boat out in the Pacific during World War II. And Mr. Roberts is like, oh my gosh, the war's going to end and I'm not going to get a chance to fight for my country. I'm on a supply ship out here. So the whole movie, this comedy, about trying to get Mr. Roberts transferred into the action. The end of the movie, they get James Cagney, who's the captain. They trick him, they kind of blackmail him into sending Mr. Roberts into a battleship in the action. The movie ends, this is a comedy. The movie ends with Jack Lemmon opening a letter from Mr. Roberts on the deck of the ship and reading to the men that Mr. Roberts has been killed in a kamikaze attack off the shores of Japan. The end. Happy ending. My young students are like, huh? What? He wanted that? It's like, yeah, he got to do it. That is something that people who go through that crisis. I just read a deal yesterday about the guys that signed the Declaration of Independence. Some of you have probably seen this. Have you ever seen the list? Almost all of them were very wealthy landowners. Have you ever seen what these guys went through? It's like, whoa! Everything. I think, in fact, that quote says it was not an idle boast. They pledged to give, and what was it again?
Lives, fortunes, and sacred honor.
And they did. I think that when you put the total of their family members and stuff, it's even significantly more than that. But you see this crisis deal. A hero generation either arises or the culture disappears. Well, I don't know if Strauss and Howe are right. I guess we'll see. I'm not banking everything on, I'm banking on Jesus instead. But I don't think this is at all inconsistent with the kind of pattern of history that the Bible lays out over and over and over again, particularly in the Old Testament. And so I go, okay, there's a saying in hockey. They say, don't skate to where the puck is, skate to where the puck's going to be. And we have the same thing here. You know, when I'm training young leaders to go plant churches, I go, we can't have them planting churches that worked in 1960. We got to figure out how we can prepare them, maybe even possibly for a crisis moment when having 20 acres and 50 people and $250,000 to plant a church isn't going to happen. Did you know that's the norm, by the way, for church planters right now? I've done a lot of assessment with church planters, and every one of them says the same thing, like they got handed a book or something. Oh, yeah, I need 50 people. $250,000 and 20 acres in hyper-suburbia. And then I can plant a really effective church. Where'd you get this? Did you get that in the Bible or something? No, but that's what you need. It's like, uh-oh, we got a problem here. We're planting churches that might have been effective, you could argue that, in the past, but probably are not going to be effective as we move through this fourth turning. Okay, well, let me shift now to the question of, is the Western Church in crisis? Are we really in crisis, or is this just a hyped up deal? Again, please let me know if you'd like sources on any of this. We have seen a 60% increase in the unchurched between 1991 and 2005, during a period of time that most seminary professors would call the era of church growth. We have guys who are professors of church growth. Can you imagine running a business with a guy who's in charge of growth of your business, and those are your numbers that come in? 60% loss of clients in this period of time. You're doing a great job. We'd like to give you a chair and endow you. Christian Schwartz is a German church consultant, I think a good one. Christian O. Schwartz, there's another Schwartz there. Christian O. Schwartz was hired by some mega churches in America to study effectiveness in evangelism. He did, and came back to them and said, you should take the money back. I'm not going to show you the study. And they said, what do you mean? He said, you don't want to see the results. I said, yeah, we want to see the results. So he showed them to them. This is not a misprint. I didn't accidentally add a zero in there. That is his statistic. Now, you can debate his statistic, but here's what he found out. Small churches are 1,600% more evangelistically effective than mega churches. Okay, now, in light of that, I have found that most young leaders are still trying to figure out how they can go build themselves a mega church. Even though we go, well, effectiveness... Schwartz is not the only one saying that. Almost all measures we have are going like not effective. But we still have leaders who are going, someday I will have a really big parking lot and, you know, some books. Neil Cole, the house church planter on the West Coast, writes in his book, Organic Church, it amazes me to consider how much effort and how many resources are expended for a single hour once a week. We have made church nothing more than a religious show that takes place on Sunday. Now, I can tell you, at least in my experience, this is true. The number of resources and the percentage of time and energy we put towards pulling off an hour service, I believe it's sincere. I believe we thought if we do that really well, Lost people will come hear the gospel, and then we'll get around to making disciples of them. But the results are in. None of those are true. Okay? Only a few churches can put on a show powerful enough that they get the opportunity. Here's what the Church Growth Institute says. 95 to 98% of all growth in churches in America is transfer growth. In other words, we emptied somebody out of Little Second Methodist, and they came to First Megachurch. And it gets worse. By the way, the book, if you're interested in this, is Henry Chadwick's Stealing Sheep, is a pretty good study of this. Chadwick says that not only do they move from the little small church over to the megachurch, and he says that could be good if they were getting more involved, but that's not the case. What happens is there are often elders in Second Methodist doing lots of hands-on ministry, and they decide they want a better show. They move to another church and now sit and watch. They're there every Sunday unless the Browns are playing. In Kansas City, that'd be the Chiefs are playing, which maybe they would go. But it has not been effective. The other thing he asks is, well, maybe that kind of transfer is helping them get better teaching or better worship or better information. Except what Schwartz found is when these people transfer from Second Methodist to First Megachurch, around 50% fall overboard. They don't make the transfer. They go a few times, and then they don't like the color of the carpet in Fellowship Hall or something, and then they just become the I'm not really connected anywhere. So we have this massive group. In fact, George Barna wrote a book about it called Revolutionaries, in which he said, we have all these people who call themselves followers of Jesus but are not connected to any kind of body. You go, well, part of that is the result of this approach. So the era of church growth has produced zero growth, and we got two crises. Attendance crisis. Best book, if you're going to read anything from everything I say, get this book. David Olson's The American Church in Crisis. David Olson is a researcher and demographer with the Evangelical Covenant Church. I believe he's still centered in California. And he's been doing this report for quite a while. But I think people have been so shocked by it that they finally talked to him, would you put all this info into a book? And so that's the book format of it, and I'm going to quote you. I have a high trust in Olson's statistics, partially because of his training, but also because David Olson has found that Christians so wrongly report their statistics that he now puts all of his statistics in front of a secular firm, Hadaway and Marler, and says, would you please check my statistics and see if I got this right? And I'll tell you a little bit about it in a second. Here's what he found. He had worked for, I can't remember whether he worked for Barna or Gallup, but one of the two big polling organizations, both led by Christians, good organizations. They have both said since the late 50s, Barna's organization didn't start till later, but since they existed, they have both said that somewhere right around 40% of Americans attend church weekly. Sometimes it drops to 38%, sometimes up to 42%, but basically right there. He said, this has remained consistent from the mid-50s. Olson started, he was working for him, and he started going, I'm going to do the math here. All right, here's 40% of the American population, so this many people should be in church. And then he would see the reports, denominational reports of how many people were in church. And he goes, I know they're over-reporting. But still, the gap, he's like, somebody's lying like crazy. So he did something really shocking. He started getting some of his young interns, and he'd go, follow these people. When they say they went to church, follow them and find out if they actually did. So, by the way, the question, Barna and Gallup asked the question exactly the same. Here's how they phrase it. Have you attended a Christian church in the last 7 days for reasons other than wedding and funeral? That's the question. So Olson starts following them up, and he says, oh my gosh, we were shocked. 50% were lying. The actual statistic in 1990, when he first reported this, was 20.4%. 40% said, yes, I've been in church in the last week other than wedding and funeral. 20% actually had. Well, Olson goes, why? Well, he says, we don't know that for sure, but here's his speculation. He says, We live in an era when Christians understand how polls work and they don't want to see a picture, a pie chart on the bottom of USA Today saying church attendance is declining in America. So they lie. And Olson calls that the halo factor. He says the halo factor is around 100%. So take however many people say they're doing it, cut it in half, and you'll get real close to the reality. So he began, and since then, I think he did his first in 88. So for quite a while now, every year, he's been reporting what the actual statistics of attendance, not what people say they'll do, but what they actually do. 20% in 1990, 18.7% in 2000, 17.7% in 2004. He hasn't published it yet, but I've seen his 2008 statistics, and he says we're now under 15%. Okay, here's the problem. When he gave Hadaway and Marler, the independent firm, his research, and he said, hey, tell me what you think of this. Tell me if I've got it wrong. They were friends of his. They'd done grad work together. They came back and they said, David, you took Statistics 101. He's like, yeah. They go, why are you even putting this out then? He goes, what are you talking about? They go, David, you have to curve your results with population growth. Otherwise, there's no meaning to them whatsoever. Because if you don't do anything, population alone should cause significant growth. At that time, it was around 20% a decade. I'm going, you should see 20% of growth a decade in the church if you don't do anything. He's like, you're right. I don't know why I did this. He goes, yeah, I do. Because for churches to raise money to build buildings, they have to convince their people they're having massive growth. We need this $10 million. We've grown 7% in the last decade. Now, here's what he found. 5.7% church growth reported from 1990 to the year 2000 was in actuality a negative loss of 7.5%. Do you see why people in America are like, I think the church is doing fine. Heck, I went to my church's year-end deal and they said, we're growing like crazy. He's like, well, yeah. Here, this is my favorite of all of his slides. He says, when he looked at states, he said, are any states producing growth in the church in America? He said, yes, there is one. Blue states are in decline. Pink? Hawaii grew in that decade. Now, here's the crazy thing. He says they went and researched. What's Hawaii doing? One church. One church in Honolulu was responsible for that growth change. You go, that's pretty scary. But again, you look at this picture, you go like, uh-oh. This is not what most people think is happening. Now, he goes on, actually not in that book, but elsewhere, he goes on to say another reason that Americans are not aware of the leak in the wineskin is what he calls the masking of the megachurch factor. We all, if we live in particularly mid to large size cities, we all know the three or four megachurches in town that we go, oh, they're growing like crazy. He's like, yeah, but that masks what's really going on in the church in that city. The analogy I use, sorry, this is a Kansas City Chiefs football analogy, but we have a receiver named Dwayne Bowe who likes to push his own stats. It's the equivalent of Dwayne Bowe saying, hey, I had 400 yards receiving today. The Chiefs lost 50-3, but I had a great day. And that's what Olson says. It's like we have churches in America saying, well, we're doing fine. In fact, when I teach this material, you know what the number one thing I get from church leaders? Oh, I totally believe this is true. However, it's not true at our church. I've never had anyone say, you know, this is true for us, too. That's denial. We have to go, okay, guys, if we're trying to advance the kingdom in America, I don't care if we have a couple of individual players with gaudy stats if we're getting killed. We're going to have to ask that question. All right, look at this next one. This is interesting. This is his years are 1990 to 2006, so it's a 15-year period. Total church attendance, 51 million in 1990. Total of church attendance in 2006, 51.5 million. It's like, okay, we're doing, you know, we're barely holding our own until you put population growth in there. That same 15-year period, population growth, $51 million. You go, uh-oh, there's a leak in the wineskin here. All right, here's the line I talked about from 20% when he first started studying this. Again, I mentioned that he thinks right now that this is wrong, that in 2008 it looks like we're already at 15%. So whatever, the trend line would suggest that by 2050 the American church will have approximately a 10.5% penetration rate, making us the same as France. We're kicking Sweden's rear. That's it, though. In Western countries, the church in America, as much as in my arrogance I thought, thank goodness we're not Scotland, what it suggests is we're about to be, and maybe a little worse. The trend pattern is a little sharper. Okay, second crisis Olson talks about is a church planting crisis. I'll go quickly through this because this may not be as interesting to you. But he said, we needed, to keep up with that 51 million population growth, we needed 24,240 new churches planted. We, in actuality, had a net gain of just under 4,000, leaving us in that 15-year period at a deficit of 20,000 church plants. Now, when I go to various places and talk about this, people will argue with me about this. They go, oh, man, there's so many church plants in our city. And cynically, I'm sorry about this, but cynically, my response will often be, yeah, I bet you they're all within a mile of the most affluent point in your city. And they're all gathered together. And I'll bet you don't have a single one urban. And I'll bet you don't have any in the rural community surrounding your city. I planted a church in a little town called Garnett, Kansas, 6,300 people. We were the first church plant in 150 years there. Why? Well, they had plenty of churches. That's why they didn't plant. The problem was those churches were such old wineskins that the new people, particularly high school students in that city, would be like, there's no way I'm going to the Nazarene church there. I'd have to learn how to be a Nazarene. That would take me like 20 years before I could ever figure out who Jesus was. No new church plants means no new converts. Here's how Olson puts it in a graph. If we look at the age of the church when it was planted compared to effectiveness and growth, you can see that only churches that are planted recently, often in new wineskins, are capable of reaching new people. Church planting is still the most effective form of evangelism we know, and we're running a deficit of 20,000 over the past 15 years. You know, we got a problem because people don't think they go, oh, we got too many churches. You go, no. We have to have new wineskin churches or all the wine's going to end up leaking out and we're going to say, what the heck happened? And that'll be a different story. All right, so why are we in decline? What's our stopping time here? Okay. Would someone like wave at me at like 3:05 so I don't get us in trouble? 1985, the conventional wisdom, I planted my first church in 1986. The conventional wisdom, which I, by the way, I agree, I think this was true, was people don't come to church because it's boring and it's irrelevant. So we planted churches that were exciting, fog machines in the lights, skits, movie clips, and relevant, felt need. We're going to talk about your finances. Parenting. I'm not against those things, by the way. I think those are good things. I think the Bible talks quite a bit about some of those. The problem is the context has changed. I do not believe that's what my unchurched neighbor is thinking right now. Some are, but most of them, I think, are thinking something different. You can come up with your own, but let me give you my three. I'm going to suggest three different words. Number one, impersonal. 20 years ago, church planters talked about, hey, let the seekers have anonymity. And I'm not even going to debate whether it was right or wrong, even though the Bible says there's no such thing as a seeker, but we won't debate that. I get the point. Today, 20-year-olds, the last thing they want is anonymity. They've had enough of it. They're like, yeah, I went to this church. In my church, after I handed it off to one of my guys, I'd see people that I know had become Christians. I'd see them at the grocery store. I'd say, how you doing? Oh, great, great. I go, you still involved? No. Well, what happened? You know what story I hear over and over again? Well, my mom died, so I couldn't go for 3 or 4 weeks, and nobody noticed. And then I wasn't around for a while, nobody noticed. I haven't gone for the last 4 years. It's like, uh-oh. We guaranteed anonymity, and we forgot to do community. They go, nobody knows. I can't tell you how often I've had, it saddens me. People will call me and go, hey, my father just died. Would you do the funeral? I go, well, aren't the people in your church? And I don't know anyone. Nobody knows about this. I'm like, what? Yeah, I'll do it, but this is wrong. This is not what it's supposed to look like to do church. They believe it's impersonal. In fact, they often will see themselves as, I'm a giving unit to this church. It's like, yeah, that is kind of the attitude. Or I've also had people who kind of did church and now kind of drifted away, and they'll say, well, actually, when I told one of the guys on staff that I was kind of struggling, they said, good, we need the seats. It's like, you gotta be kidding me. It's like, that's a little different than Jesus' model of the shepherd who leaves the 99 and inconveniences them to go seek the one. In the church growth era, the idea is, hey, we got a lot of people who'd like to transfer to our cool guy thing. So move it on. Same thing. You know what's happened in youth ministry? We have churches that talk about their kids like, hey, just because their parents go here doesn't mean they go here. You're like, okay, I get what they're saying, but I go, what happened to the idea that we're going to pastor you and your family? It's like, something got lost here. So they've concluded it's impersonal. It's impersonal. So it's no big deal if I show up every once in a while. I need a little fix. I got really high last night, so I'll go to church and see if I can make up for it today. Normal. Second, selfish. I believe that our unchurched neighbors often look at the church as the most selfish institution in America. By the way, I really cannot validate this one, but I read a book. Anybody read The Day America Told the Truth? It's a secular book by some guys. They said that pastors, when they ask about how people viewed them in the community, pastors were the second to last lowest ranking. We were beating mafia dons, but that's it. Strippers were doing better than us. You go, what? Boy, if you're in Christendom, you don't think that's true. But basically, the book was saying, well, people out there, they go like, you guys are out there building your own kingdom. You're horrible. You're like IRS agents. You're out there. I'm just a giving unit to you. They view selfish. By the way, we'll look at this book in a second. The Notre Dame guys that studied this in a book called Passing the Plate, they said that the average person in America sees that giving money to the Red Cross is a much better decision than giving it to the local church. Now, we don't have time for me to go into my harangue about things I've seen with the Red Cross. It doesn't even matter whether it's accurate or not. The point is, the perception is, you guys are going to take my money and you're going to recarpet your fellowship hall. That's what you're going to do with it. You're building your own little country club there. I had some students, we were looking at a church, a really good church, by the way, and the students came back to do the report, the one student did, and he's saying, yeah, I couldn't finish the report. I go, well, what do you mean? He goes, I was just too sick. Tell me, they go, they're trying to build a $4 million bridge from their parking lot so they can get more people to their church building over a highway. I go, these are really good guys. I know one of these. He's a great guy. They're like, oh, I'm just that's just unbelievable. They're actually going to get people to go, so we can not inconvenience people. They don't have to walk around the block and push the crosswalk button. They can walk over their own private bridge over the highway. They're like, I just couldn't do this. I gave up on trying to convince them. This is really a great church with great people in it. They were just like, selfish. That's what's going on there. Third thing, hypocritical. I don't need to go into this too much. It's a cliche. Most of you understand that your next door neighbor goes, church people, no different. In fact, they tend towards thinking they're worse. They're probably worse than the animus that lives on the other side of me. All right, I'm going to go through those real quickly. Impersonal, if you want to plumb that a little bit, I'd encourage you to read sociologist David Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. Anybody read Bowling Alone? It's a cool book. It's a kind of, you can skim it pretty quick. His basic thesis is this is what's changed in American culture. 50 years ago, people bowled in leagues. Today, they bowl more than they did back then, but they do it alone or with one other person. In other words, he's basically articulating the death of community in America, the breakup of the extended family. So we're got a wineskin trying to say, we want to guarantee you anonymity when we have a generation of people going, I'm longing for some form of connection. I want to be a part of, I want them to know when I'm gone. And so we have a problem. Acts chapter 2 is the problem. When I take my students through this and I say, okay, let's go through and start putting up on the whiteboard observations. What do you notice about the description of the church in Acts chapter 2? You want to know, I haven't had a class for 7 or 8 years that hadn't come to this. Very first one, you know what they all notice? These are all young 20-year-olds. Every day. That's what they notice. I'm like, yeah, that's in there. What else? And they go, no. That's unbelievable. We don't do that. How come we don't do that? I remember when my son was 18, he asked, Dad, how come we don't do that? And I go, you know why, hon? I can tell you that my seminary professors and church leaders would often say, hey, the average committed person in America will give you 2.5 slots a week. That's it. I go, uh-oh, we got a problem. You can't do this on 2.5 slots a week. I know Zenos gets more criticism probably than maybe than anything else of the amount of time. I think, Gary, you guys call it high ethos, high commitment ethos. This is the thing I'm guessing that you guys take shots for like nothing else. But we have a generation of people who are going, no, this is what I want. Every day I'm a part of the community. We have a model in the American church that said, we lecture people, you ought to do your devotion. You ought to study the scriptures. Good luck. We'll see you next week. It's not working. I did a study in my church years ago where we call that abiding in Christ. And we'd say, it became easily the number one priority of everyone in the church. And then when I asked performance, it placed last. I'm like, okay, we have a problem here. We're telling people, you need to do this, you need to do this. This is the most important thing you can do. But, you know, you got to have plenty of time to watch TV. You got a lot of games to play. We don't set it up. I used to threaten my church. I don't know why I didn't follow through with it. I used to say, okay, guys, starting tomorrow morning, we meet every morning at 6 a.m. We're gonna learn to abide together. Everybody. And everyone laugh. That's hilarious. Well, I at least got enough guts. Now I require all my staff, all my students, every morning, they have to be together. They can't do it alone. They have to be together learning. We call it Acts 6 time, where the apostles in Acts chapter 6 say, hey, it's not right for us to spend our time waiting tables and neglect the word of God in prayer. We will devote ourselves to these things, and we'll assign some men full of the Holy Spirit to do these other things. It says it seemed good to everyone. They were like, yep, that makes sense. We're a long ways away from that. We're impersonal. Selfish, again, the giving patterns of American Christians are within the margin of error, the same as the giving patterns of lost people in America. You go, in the most affluent nation in history, there's no distinction. No wonder they think something's wrong. U.S. church building holdings are currently $230 billion. If you've ever been to the Vatican, I'm going to have to say one of the most disturbing spiritual experiences of my life, having walked through some of the poverty in some of the Roman streets and then going to the Vatican, I'm like, no wonder the church thinks we're selfish. I mean, we have so much junk, valuable junk. They don't have enough rooms to store it in here. Of course they think we're selfish. Because to some degree we are. Or I am, at least. Okay, last one, hypocritical. I'm not going to go through this much, but if you're interested, Ron Sider from Eastern University, I think Ron teaches on the seminary side, wrote a book called The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, in which he says, is there any difference in the behavior and morality of Christians versus non-Christians in our society?
And Ron's, I've heard him talk about it. He goes, I'm so sad I wrote that book because I knew that there wasn't much. I just didn't know it was bad. When I started doing the research, I got more and more depressed about this. He's like, no difference in divorce rates. Racism, this is the one he said disturbed him more than anything else. He said the research wasn't, it wasn't like kind, it was like clear. The most likely people to protest living next to a neighbor of a different race were white evangelicals. Ron went like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? Could we find an area that our culture thinks is more an indication that we're hypocrites? Could we find an area? I don't think we could. Sexuality, not much difference in anything. We don't need to go back. Finances, we've already talked about. The point Sider wants to make is it's very difficult to be effective in a culture when their primary view is, of you is you're more hypocritical than the pagan next door. And that is their view, whether we want it to be or not. By the way, I haven't updated this, but a good book on this, David Kinnaman wrote a book recently called You Lost Me. It's about people who'd become followers of Christ but kind of drifted away. And he went and he said, why? Top of their list. Guys are hypocrites. I just couldn't do it anymore. Following Jesus or trying even to think about that apart from the church is better. You know, we got a problem. Okay, impersonal, selfish, hypocritical. No wonder we're in crisis. Again, if you got different words there, please let me know. I don't have a corner on that. All right, I bummed you out for a while, so let me spend 10 minutes trying to do the opposite. As disturbing as the picture of the leak in the American wineskin is, I cannot tell you. In fact, I have to review this all the time for myself because my cynicism looks at this and goes, this is probably not right. I'm trying to do the best job I can of resourcing this information here. Some of it's hard to get. But here's what we know for sure. The explosion of the church globally dwarfs the first 300 years of the church. It's not close. We are living, church historians, if we make it that long, and a couple hundred years ago, we are living in the most significant era of the growth of the church in history, and it isn't even close, which again encourages me and bothers me. I'm like, Lord, the church is exploding almost everywhere on the planet except Western Europe and North America. I'm like, sucks to be a North American right now. I go, we gotta figure that out. But I have to say, I'm super encouraged when I look at this. Africa, 1900, best shot they had is about 8% penetration of the population. By 2000, that was 45%. I just talked with Austin Okamohu, the director of Campus Crusade in the north half of Africa, and he laughed and laughed about that. He said, oh, brother, no, it's at least 60% now. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah, if you want, I'll send you all of our research on that. I'm like, so you think that's a conservative? He goes, very, very conservative. I go, okay. China, 1950. They think when the Western missionaries were kicked out of China, I went to seminary with a bunch of guys who grew up there. Their parents were missionaries, and they were exiled from the country. 1950, they estimated 700,000 Christians. One of my professors who had been a child there, his parents had been Chinese missionaries. I can remember sitting in class and watching this grown man sob and sob when the curtain came up and they went, we're worried what we're going to find in China. Instead, they went, what? What the heck happened here? We have no idea how. We kind of are putting together how it happened. But the most conservative estimate of growth of the church in China, this is the Communist Party statistic, is 40 million believers. Okay, from 700,000 in 50 years to 40 million. Now, they can only count people who register above ground in the TCPM's churches. So the underground church, far, far bigger, we're having a hard time. There are two books I'd suggest if you're interested in this. Jesus in Beijing by David Aikman, good book. I believe he was a Time or a Newsweek reporter, Time magazine reporter. I think it's a pretty solid piece of work. A more detailed one is called China's Christian Millions. And his name is slipping me right now. If you're interested, ask me. I've got it somewhere. He went county by county all through all of China trying to go numerically, can we figure out what's going on here? His suggestion is that we're somewhere over 100 million, probably in the 120 to 130 million range. Whatever it is, it's meteoric. It's unbelievable. I've been over a couple times personally, working with underground seminaries in southwest China, and anecdotally, I can say, yeah, the growth is disturbing. Their struggles, by the way, they have a lot of struggles. Their struggles come from this incredibly rapid growth. They don't have enough leaders. Heresy is a very difficult problem. I remember somebody saying, well, you know, heresy and everything. And I heard a Chinese guy say, well, our heresy is different than yours. So what do you mean? He goes, you have heresy of intransigence, people who know what Jesus taught and simply won't do it. Ours is primarily heresy of innocence. We have guys that go, I can't have five wives. I didn't know that. Should I divorce four of them? They're like, well, wait, hold on. We got to think this one through. They go, it is a different kind of heresy. But they're struggling with that because they're in those early stages, just like the letters that Paul sent to the emerging churches going, guys, I know somebody told you that Jesus already came, but I'm writing you this letter to say, no, he hadn't come yet. So same thing. Latin America. The growth in Latin America is a little different. Most Latin Americans would have called themselves Christian. They would have been what World Vision calls Voodoo Catholics, which means nominal Catholicism kind of mixed with animism. Their revival has primarily been moving from kind of a nominality to a sincere biblical commitment. And that has been as stunning as Africa and China. Brazil was 8% Protestant in 1980, 93, it was at 22. I haven't confirmed this one, but someone told me that in 2000 that was pushing 50%. I don't know if that's accurate or not. Guatemala, again, the growth rate was 570% a decade. That's some scary stuff there. I don't have time to go into the Muslim world if you want to read about that. I'm pretty sure the guy that's doing seminars here tomorrow probably has a better picture of that than I would. I've read four or five books on that. One I would suggest, even though I would not suggest the statistics, I cannot tell you whether they're accurate or not, is called Inside the Revolution by Joel Rosenberg. I also know the guys that do disciple-making movements. David Watson, I don't know the name of his book, just wrote a book about what's going on in the Muslim world. Contrary to popular opinion, America, Islam is not the fastest growing religion in the world. Even many Muslim leaders are decrying the problem of how many, not of normal people, but of their upper level society, are now becoming followers of Jesus, and often do so not because missionaries got to them, because many of them are having visions of Jesus. So you go, well, I don't know all the details. I can't give you an accurate picture there, but what we're being told is that's significant. These get known as church planting movements. The next book I would suggest to you, in fact, for me, no book has created more learning or a shift in paradigms for me than this book. David Garrison, head of Southern Baptist Missions, started out originally writing pamphlets. Now it's a book form called Church Planting Movements. Garrison was in charge of seeing his people on the field and distributing the money from Southern Baptists. He would go into cities like Manila, and they'd go, we're putting crazy money to build a giant Western cathedral in Manila, and we've got a handful of American expatriates and a few Filipinos who want to learn to speak English. So initially he said, well, let's just shut this down. This is stupid. Do you know what his workers there said? No, don't do that. Out the back door, it's growing like rabbits. I told him the story of one farmer who'd become a Christian who planted 1,600 house churches in the last 5 years. It's a farmer. He's going, don't kill this thing. This is kind of like, we'll do the cathedral thing here in Manila as like a sham so that we can continue equipping the guys out the back door who are multiplying like crazy. So he began seeing this all over the world. And so he started getting his leaders together, and he put three whiteboards up, and he said, all right, let's put on one whiteboard the stuff that every one of you do. Let's see if there's something that everybody is doing that's causing these church planting movements. Then he had a whiteboard, some of you do it, some of you don't, and then he had one that said, none of you do this. His book is the 10 things that came out on the whiteboard that every church planting movement he'd been exposed to globally does. And again, you can debate these, but I'm just going to touch on a couple of them. Number one, extraordinary prayer. Garrison said, I cannot tell you how much Americans are going to hear that and go, yep, we agree with that. He's going, no, no, you don't. You have a completely different understanding of corporate prayer. Oftentimes, prayer meetings in global church movements are weeks, sometimes months-long, nonstop prayer movements. This is normative for them. He would say, then we'll talk to people in America, they'll go, we agree with this. And they'll go, no, you have a once-a-month prayer meeting, which is mainly somebody giving a talk and then 10 minutes of prayer at the end. He's going, you don't understand this. This is a distinction. By the way, for me, I began to ask the question, okay, if the global church is exploding and the American church is declining, why are we writing all the books and doing all the conferences? This is kind of the equivalent of the Chiefs putting together a DVD saying, here's how you win the Super Bowl. Can you imagine what Bill Belichick and the Patriots would do when they got that DVD? I think they'd actually watch it because they'd be like, this is going to be hilarious. But we're still demanding in the global church that we should tell them how this should be done. It doesn't make any sense. Sometimes I wish that our global brethren were more vocal about that. They're often very kind, like, oh, teach us more. It's like, yes, we'll teach you how to run this thing into the ground. We're experts at this. Extraordinary prayer. Second thing, this one shocked me more than anything. It shocked Garrison, too. He calls it abundant gospel sowing. He says, in America, this idea has occurred that you can't evangelize people unless you barbecue with them for a few months. You've got to earn the right to be heard. And I've taught this myself many, many, many times. And I even get the biblical roots of that concept. I understand some of that. But they challenged there. They'd say, no, we believe the power of the gospel is in the seed, not in the sower. You in the West, you think the power is in the sower. And what a great job you do. We don't. We think the power's in the seed. So we throw the seed liberally. We understand some will fall on hard path. Birds will eat some. We understand that. But the one in four in Jesus' parable that finds good soil, sometimes 30, 50, 100-fold it produces. Now, anybody that's been doing ministry, you understand that. You invest in someone who becomes a true disciple of Jesus that can make other disciples, and you go, wow. They have disproportionate impact. Well, in the global church, they teach their people to immediately go sow with everybody and leave the results to the Holy Spirit. Yeah. Oh, we're on time. Thank you so much. Okay, next one, leaders, not professionals. I mentioned I'd been doing some training stuff in the underground church in Southwest China. I remember asking one of those leaders after our little organized meeting there, I was asking him, his English was really good, I was asking him, like, what's the ratio of, like, paid people in the Chinese underground church to the people that you're pastoring? I don't know what you're saying. So I kept asking him, he just couldn't get the question. So I asked my translator friend there, I go, could you see if you could take a run at that? He did, and I could see him there talking Mandarin, and he finally says, yeah, he says he doesn't really have the slightest idea, really, because we don't measure that kind of stuff. But his best guess would be they run one full-time person to every 50 to 60,000 believers. I go, are you kidding me? He said, well, it's probably like more 1 to 100,000, but I'm going to say 1 to 50,000. I'm sitting there thinking, I've taught these seminars, I'm going, in American churches, the average is one full-time Christian worker to every 110 people. In mega churches, it drops to 1 to 75. And I go, if we go through crisis, we can't afford this model. This is not going to work. I don't think we can afford it right now, and it's not working that well. We go 1 to 100... and we're declining, they're going 1 to 50,000 and exploding. I go, we need to start listening to this. Last thing is, sometimes I used to try and apologize for this. Like, well, it doesn't have to be. But Garrison would say, we have not found a single church planting movement anywhere that we know of where the leaders were not organizing based on cells, house churches, whatever label they use. You go, we haven't found it. And yet, I continue, when I talk about this in American churches, they're like, this is a new and fascinating idea. It's like, really? It's not really a new or even that fascinating. It's kind of what Jesus did. They're like, well, yes. All right, well, that brings us to the last thing. Again, we've tried a lot of things to patch the hole. We've tried to go, could we produce more Bill Hybels? I love Bill Hybels, by the way. I know a few people are saying. Here's what I believe, though. God gifts the church with apostolic leaders like Bill. They're powerful. They're like a stick of dynamite. But we cannot train those. They're gifts from God. I've been training young leaders. I don't have any Bill Hybels yet. I have some great leaders. But this is something that the Holy Spirit chooses to bestow on the church. And we should use it as much as we can, maximize it. But the idea of planting churches where we go, let's see if we can find ourselves a Bill Hybels, it's a bad idea. It doesn't work. And it crushes an awful lot of people in ministry who go, I'm trying to put my Bill Hybels pants on. I just can't get there. You're not supposed to get there. That's like David wearing Saul's armor. It's not necessary. Not necessary. So that hadn't worked. We're still trying it, though. The cash patch, again, the idea that we'll give them $250,000 and 20 acres. Well, it hasn't worked. That has not patched the hole. The suburban patch, where we go, we're going to plant churches in the highest growth affluent areas we can because they're the only ones that can afford this approach to doing ministry. It hasn't worked. So how do we stop the leaks? Here's the key question. I got this in an online discussion with a house church, African house church planter. He was discussing this with English and American Canadian guys online. And he kind of stopped in the middle of the deal. He goes, guys, you need to make a decision. Was the ministry of Jesus and the early apostles meant to be a model for how we to do it? Or is it just one way to skin the cat? Was Jesus' ministry meant to be followed as a template? Was he saying, do it like this, guys? Or was he saying, here's a way I like to do it, but you can do it any way you want? That question haunted me. I started going, I really struggled with it because I'm an American and I had this deal of, well, there's a million ways we can do it. No model is better than the other. Till somebody helped me, I read a journal article that helped me make a distinction between template and model. Okay, here's, they used baseball as an analogy. They said, the template of baseball does not change from New York to Kansas City to Cleveland to Cincinnati. It's the same everywhere. You can't go, oh, well, in Houston, they only play with two outs. It's like, no, it's not baseball. There are certain things about the template that cannot be changed or it ceases to be baseball. On the other hand, the model, how you play the game, changes from city to city. The Yankees, big market, a lot of money, they just go buy as many All-Stars and Cy Young winners as they can. We can't do that in Kansas City. We're owned by a guy who runs Walmart. So we have to figure out how we're going to find these diamonds in the rough and sign them to long-term contracts when they're like 19. Well, we don't have a chance. It's a different model for how we play, but the template is the same. I believe the same thing is true about ministry. This is the conviction I've come to. Jesus and the apostles gave us a template of how to make disciples. Now, we're going to have to take, whether it's Columbus, Kansas City, Britain, we're going to have to take that and contextualize the model, but we don't change the template. Whenever we have, we've had loss. And what I can see in church history is the same thing. John Wesley understood the template. He called it something different, called it class meetings. He had different labels. And I'm like, okay, he understood Anglicanism in his day, and so he had to figure out the model. But the template is the same. When I go see the underground church in China, we're talking the same language. Now, their context is wildly different. But we can talk about doing ministry because the template transcends. It's the wine that remains. We're going to have to reconcile that because... again, obviously, the New Testament template, and part of the reason we've been very interested in Xenos is because we see this as a movement that's going, okay, we're going to just do the template. Now, the model here is really different. Some people come up here and they'll go like, oh, yeah, we don't want to smoke, drink, and cuss as much as you. It's like, forget that. That's contextual. That has nothing to do with it. The issue is the template. Now, if I got up here and what I'd seen was people go, oh, we're like contextualizing for the culture, but while we did that, we got rid of the wine of the gospel, I'd go, I'm out of here. But that's not what I see. I see a movement that's going, no, we're going to study the scriptures and learn the template and try and reproduce.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.